From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, one of the originators of the skateboarding moves that turned skateboarding into a phenomenon. Stacy Peralta was a member of the Z-Boys, a skateboard team from Santa Monica that in the early 70s developed their style on city streets, school playgrounds, and empty swimming pools. Their moves were inspired by their favorite surfers. Peralta has made a new documentary about the team called Dogtown and Z-Boys. It won the Audience and Directors Awards at Sundance and is now opening in theaters. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new CD I Get Wet by Andrew W.K., and book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Bad Blood, a memoir by the late literary critic Lorna Sage. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has begun 2 days of talks with the Bush administration. He met today with Secretary of State Colin Powell and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and goes to the White House tomorrow. NPR's Vicki O'Hara reports.
As the United States is trying to arrange an international meeting to discuss the Middle East, Israeli officials are detailing their objections to Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. Prime Minister Sharon arrived in Washington with over 100 pages of documents purportedly seized from Arafat's headquarters. Israel says the material shows that Arafat uses foreign aid money to fund terrorism. U.S. officials declined to comment, saying they need to see the documents. Sharon and other Israeli officials are calling for a change in Palestinian leadership. They say Israel can't negotiate with Arafat. Bush administration officials acknowledge Arafat's shortcomings, but say they cannot choose a leader for the Palestinian people. However, the Bush administration is calling for reforms in the way the Palestinian Authority operates. Vicki O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
President Bush traveled to Southfield, Michigan today to promote his education agenda. The president wants to encourage school districts to implement the education reform package he signed in January. The reforms call for yearly testing in an effort to ensure that schools are performing well. In the Netherlands, a right-wing political leader was assassinated today as he left a radio interview. Reporter Greg Crouch says Pim Fortuyn felt his anti-immigration views put him in danger.
Pim Fortuyn complained that he wasn't given any Secret Service protection by the government. In fact, he said that if he were to be killed, that it would be the prime minister's fault. And, of course, there's no known connection between the government and what has happened today. But he was complaining about the fact that the government had not provided him with Secret Service protection. And he was very concerned about his safety.
Reporter Greg Crouch in the Netherlands. A top State Department official charged today that Cuba may be passing biological weapons technology to what he called rogue states. In a speech to the Conservative Heritage Foundation, Undersecretary of State John Bolton said Cuban biological weapons technology could support biological weapons programs in such nations as Iraq, Syria, and Libya. Bolton said that Cuban President Fidel Castro visited all three nations last year. He said that Cuba has one of the most advanced pharmaceutical industries in Latin America and has at least a limited offensive biological warfare program. In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrials lost 198 points, or nearly 2%, to close at 9,808 in moderate trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index lost 34 points to close at 1,578. The S&P 500 lost 20, or 1.9%. This is NPR News. The Archbishop of Boston has been ordered to give a deposition in the civil case against a priest accused of sexually abusing children. A judge said that Cardinal Bernard Law must give his deposition soon. The move came after the Finance Council of the Archdiocese rejected a settlement in the case, which involves more than 100 alleged victims of former priest John Gagan. San Diego County authorities say a retired Catholic priest is en route to Massachusetts to face child rape charges. Eric Anderson reports from member station KPBS.
Reverend Paul Shanley, who was arrested in San Diego last Thursday, waived his right to contest extradition in a brief court hearing late last week. Massachusetts authorities have levied 3 charges of child rape against Shanley after a young man came forward with allegations of abuse. The unidentified man contacted authorities after seeing news reports that the church was aware of allegations against the retired priest. The man says Shanley, over a 7-year period, repeatedly took him out of a religion class and molested him. The alleged abuse occurred while Shanley was a priest in Newton, Massachusetts. Shanley served there until the church transferred him to a parish in San Bernardino, California, in 1990. He's been living in San Diego since 1993. For NPR News, I'm Eric Anderson in San Diego.
Authorities in Nebraska say another pipe bomb has been found in a rural mailbox. No one was injured by the bomb, which did not explode when it was found in the mailbox of a person who'd been away for the weekend. The device was the 8th bomb found in Nebraska and the 16th found in a 3-state area that includes Illinois and Iowa. The bombs were accompanied by anti-government statements. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, promoting excellence in journalism worldwide and investing in the vitality of 26 U.S. communities.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new documentary, Dogtown and Z-Boys, tells the story of the skateboarders who virtually invented the moves that turned skateboarding into a phenomenon. The film won the Audience Award and Director's Award at last year's Sundance Film Festival and is opening in theaters around the country. My guest is the director and co-writer, Stacy Peralta. He's also one of the subjects of the film. Peralta was one of the original members of the Z-Boys, a team of skateboarders in the early 70s from Santa Monica and Venice, California. The Z-Boys took its name from the Zephyr Shop, a surf shop that sponsored the Zephyr Surf Team, the best-known surfers in the area known as Dogtown. The Zephyr brand of surfing, which inspired the Z-Boys, had a more urban sensibility than the Southern California image, as two of the shop's founders explain in this clip.
Our history is based on low riders and hot rods and Latinas. And, like, I'd fantasize about chicks with huge hair and low riders, you know what I'm saying? Little blonde girls, you know, named Buffy just weren't my scene. So, therefore, that wasn't what we were at.
The average surf look at the time, the aesthetic of surfing was very clean, very powder blue, very beige, you know, rainbows and sunsets and sandy beaches kind of a look. What we were doing was the debris meets the sea.
A clip from Dogtown and Z-Boys, directed by Stacy Peralta. Stacy Peralta, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me.
Did you grow up surfing and skateboarding?
Yes. I started skateboarding on a little skateboard scooter with a box crate on the top of it when I was probably about 4 years old in front of my grandfather's house in West Los Angeles. And then I started surfing when I was, I think, about 11 years old. So I, you know, that was, skateboarding was what led me into surfing, and then skateboarding is what I did to facilitate to become a better surfer.
Interesting. Now, describe your part of the ocean when you were surfing. Let's talk about the surfing, and then we'll get to the skateboarding.
When you say my part of the ocean, I mean as far as the ocean we had access to?
Exactly.
Well, we grew up in West Los Angeles in an area which is basically South Santa Monica, Ocean Park, and North Venice. And it was given the nickname back in the 70s of Dogtown. At that time, it was pretty much a rundown piece of coastline, what we used to refer to as, you know, the seaside slum or where the debris meets the sea. And it was not a world-class surf break, so to become a good surfer there, you had to work very, very hard because the waves were not as good as, say, like in Hawaii or, say, up in Malibu or down in Mexico or something like that. And as a result of that, we kind of had an underdog mentality. And there was one specific break in town that you were not allowed to surf unless you were a really, really good surfer, and that was at the side of what was called the Pacific Ocean Park Pier. And it was an abandoned amusement park built on this pier right at what is now Rose Avenue. And in that pier, there was kind of this little horseshoe bay that was hidden from sight. And the break was basically run by a surf mafia. And it was very Darwinian. If you were good enough, you could get in there and surf. But if you weren't and you went in there without their permission, you might not come out completely whole, because they were very, very serious about, very territorial about what they were doing.
Who ran the surf mafia?
It was a number of guys that were associated with the Jeff Ho and Zephyr Surfboard Shop. And these were the guys, these were the top of the food chain surfers. They were the best guys on the beach. They were all the guys that we idolized as kids and kind of mythologized. And when we were surfing the normal break, which was called Bay Street, which was down the beach about a mile, we would see all these guys surfing, and that's what we – they were who we were aspiring to. You know, we were probably 13, 14 years old. They were probably 18 to 25. And they were really talented athletes, but when the waves would switch, the tides would switch, this area near Pacific Ocean Park would get very good, and we would know that we were not allowed to go there. It was just a given. You cannot go in there, and if you did, they were going to hurt you.
Did you ever get in?
Well, I went in there as a 14-year-old kid one time. I snuck in there with some friends, and I had my life threatened. This guy that ran it said, he goes, if I ever catch you here again, I'll kill you, and I'll bury you under the pier. Now, I don't think he would have done that, but when you're a 14-year-old kid and you're told that that's going to happen to you by a pretty mean-looking 21-year-old, you take it very seriously. And so we basically left skid marks in the sand and never came back until we got older and became good surfers and finally were let in.
Now, what about surfing applies to skateboarding? What did you learn surfing that applies when you're on a skateboard?
Well, number one, you're standing up on a moving board, on a moving object. You're not bolted into the board. You're not like roller skates or like snowboarding or something like that, or like snow skis. You're standing free. You can fall off of it. And the motion of it, the type of turns that you do are very similar.
Is your center of gravity and the way you can move the board really different in the ocean than it is on a skateboard on the concrete?
It is very different, actually. I mean, it comes down to like a finesse. You move your body in a slightly different way when you surf because you're riding a much bigger board, and you're also riding on a piece of water that's actually moving. So as a result of that wave moving, you're adjusting in a different way than you are on a skateboard, because when you're on a skateboard, you're riding a piece of cement that does not move, that remains the same all the time. So although there are similar sensibilities, there is a dynamic that does, it is different between the two of them.
I'd like you to compare falling on a surfboard in the ocean to falling off a skateboard on the concrete.
There really is no comparison. When you fall off a surfboard, you land in water, and it's usually kind of enjoyable. Unless you're, you know, of course, surfing on top of a coral reef, which you can land on, of course. But when you fall on a skateboard, you hit concrete, and you're not only falling on concrete, but you're falling on concrete very, very fast. You're going 20 miles an hour, and you normally slam body first right onto it, so it doesn't feel good. And it the bones don't like it as well, nor does the skin. And as a result of that, we had to learn at a very, very early age, we had to learn to fall, because when we were skateboarding back in the 60s and 70s, there was no such thing as knee pads and elbow pads and helmets for skateboards. And so unless you learned how to roll out of your falls and absorb the shock, you couldn't skate. You just had to stop and find something else to do in your life.
How did you learn how to fall?
By being very serious about what you're doing. We were very serious. We're very, very committed to what we were doing. We loved skateboarding, and we weren't going to stop for anything. And as a result of that, it was part of the creed that if you're going to do this, you have to learn how to do this. And so after falling a number of times and bruising up your elbows and wrists, you start learning that you have to roll, and your roll dissipates the impact. And so that's what would happen. And that's not to say that we didn't have our slams on top of that, because we did. And boy, we took plenty. But, you know, it's one of those things when you love doing something so much, you're willing to pay whatever price there is to pay. So if it meant slamming into concrete, we were willing to do that. And many of us to this day have places on our hips that are completely dead. The nerves have been smashed so many times that they're just gone.
What about you?
Yeah, feeling's gone. There's places on my hip, the hip pointers, that there is no more nerve. There are no more nerve endings.
What was skateboarding like when you guys started? Not what did you do, but what was done before you, so that we could see the difference between what you were doing and what your predecessors did.
Well, skateboarding had a very, very brief boom in the 60s. I think it was in 64, 65. And the kids back then were riding very, very small little teeny skateboards, very thin, with clay wheels. And clay wheels, if you don't know what a clay wheel is, it's basically a wheel made of rock. And it was, for the most part, what you would call Flintstone technology. They were actually quite dangerous. And so there was quite a limit to what you could do on a skateboard back then. You could do handstands, you could do nose wheelies, and basic tic-tacs and 180s and things like that. But you really couldn't ride bank walls and ride swimming pools. And what happened in 1974 is the urethane wheel was developed. And the urethane wheel was basically like a like a rubber wheel, but it was urethane, very soft, and it gripped the ground. So for the first time on a skateboard, you could ride terrain that had never been ridden before. And as a result of that being invented in 74, and as a result of Los Angeles experiencing probably the worst drought in 100 years in the years of 74 and 75, all of these swimming pools in Los Angeles were lying empty because the government would not allow you to fill your pool with water because of the drought. You weren't even allowed to water your lawn. You weren't even allowed to serve water in restaurants. And so as a result of that, we were able to ride this new type of terrain, which was vertical skateboarding, which had never been done before. It had been attempted briefly in the 60s, but the kids couldn't do anything with it because it was so dangerous on those clay wheels.
When you say vertical skateboarding, you mean like going up the side of a wall?
Yeah, like the pools that are in Beverly Hills and Malibu and Bel Air, the rich neighborhoods in Los Angeles, they have these very deep, 10-foot deep pools shaped like peanuts or kidneys. And they were beautiful, perfect skate parks for us in a sense. And we started riding on these. We, you know, there was a couple of abandoned homes that someone had discovered a pool in, and we went into that abandoned home, started riding this pool, and in a sense started developing vertical skateboarding, which I guess many people are starting to say was the beginning of extreme sports. And we absolutely fell in love with this and at the time realized that we had to keep finding empty pools. And so we would do whatever it took to find them.
Now, one of the things you liked about the pools was that the walls weren't at a right angle. It was a kind of sloping wall, so you could skate up it pretty easily. Well, not easy for me, but I mean, relatively easily.
Well, no, what's unusual is California, especially Los Angeles, has an indigenous type of swimming pool that I'm assuming comes from that kind of the movie star pools. Mm-hmm. They're these beautiful, voluptuous bowls, very sensuous in their shapes, and the transitions, like you're saying, are very, very smooth going up to vertical, where as opposed to like on the East Coast, where a lot of the pools are square and they're actually very unrideable. Well, Los Angeles was filled with these things. In fact, I believe it's the swimming pool capital of the world. So we would go from backyard to backyard looking for all the different shapes of pools we could ride because each pool offered a different possibility, a different way to expand your abilities, your skateboarding abilities.
So did all the wealthy people with empty pools in their backyards welcome you skateboarding in their pools?
No, none of them welcomed us. It was a situation where it was like putting candy in front of a kid's face. Because the drought was there, because there were so many empty pools, I was the only guy on the team that had on the Zephyr skateboard team that had a car. So we would pile into my car with one guy on the roof, and we would drive down alleys in Beverly Hills with one guy on the roof looking into backyards. And when we would come across a backyard with an empty pool, we'd then drive in front of the house. We'd see if anybody was home. And if they weren't home, we'd sneak into the backyard and we'd skate it for a while until we heard, you know, a car pull up the driveway, at which point we'd sneak out of the place and, you know, and take off and look for the next one.
Were you caught?
Yeah, we were caught a few times. Yes, we were. I talk about this in the film. There was one time we were caught in what was called the Canyon Pool, and it was right across the street from the actor Peter Graves' house. And he didn't like us skateboarding there because he felt, you know, we were bringing in too much of a bad element into a really nice neighborhood. So they were constantly calling the police on us. And we were actually skateboarding in an abandoned home. It was the home of this kind of California cultural guy named Leo Carrillo. And it was a big estate in the Santa Monica Canyon. And so this one time the cops came and we all hid in the trees. And the cops were looking for us below us, you know, in the trees, not knowing we were hiding up above. And at the time I remember being afraid, thinking, I'm going to get nervous, I'm going to probably drop my skateboard, and I'm going to knock one of these guys in the head, and then there's going to be real problems. But, of course, that didn't happen. But they eventually found us. They put us in the back of the car, and they scared us, said, look, you know, we're going to take you down to the police station. You're going to be in big trouble. And then all of a sudden, they let us go because they realized that what we were doing was pretty absurd. We weren't hurting anybody.
My guest is Stacy Peralta. He's the director of the documentary Dogtown and Z-Boys about the team of skateboarders that invented the moves that turned skateboarding into a phenomenon. Peralta was one of the original Z-Boys in the 70s. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Stacy Peralta, and he directed the new film Dogtown and Z-Boys, which is a documentary about the early skateboarders in the 60s and 70s in Southern California who made skateboarding into an extreme sport. What was the Dog Bowl?
The Dog Bowl was a pool, a huge pool on a huge estate in Upper Santa Monica, just off this kind of pristine boulevard called San Vicente. And this was a pool that was discovered after we had all kind of like become famous skateboarders. And what happened was there was a kid living there with his parents, and the kid was our age. And he he had brain cancer. And he only had about 6 months left to live. And he went to his father one day and he said, "Look, Dad, I only have 6 months left to live. Would you let me drain the pool so all my friends can come here and skate with, you know, and just hang out and I can, you know, have my friends here?" And his father said, "Sure." And his father was a very, you know, obviously a very wealthy man that could have, you know, been sued if a kid got hurt in that pool. But he was very sweet to his child, you know, in his last 6 months of living there, and said, "Go ahead and empty the pool and have your kids, you know, have your friends here every day." And so that kind of became the de facto Dogtown pool where everyone would go to every day and not have to risk being arrested or being kicked out. And as a result of that, it enabled us to learn a lot of maneuvers because we didn't have to keep looking over our back. And in fact, Tony Alva started doing the first frontside airs in that pool, which was pretty much a revolution at that time, you know, as far as leaving the pool and riding into the air, floating through air.
So it was the first, like, aerial move?
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of a zeitgeist. There was a couple of other guys throughout California that were attempting aerials at that time and kind of pulling them off. But Tony was the first guy to really do it with beauty and grace. And really lay down the laws that if you're going to do an aerial, this is the way you should do it. It was like watching a matador facing a really terrifying bull. You know, in the middle of this very dangerous maneuver, this very aggressive maneuver, he was just looking so beautiful and so stylish. And, you know, there was a wonderfully aggressive, sensuous quality to it. And so he kind of laid down the rules of how other skaters should follow in years to come.
Well, did you worry about the physical consequences a lot?
No, we didn't worry about that. We were aware of it, but we didn't worry about it because we were so hungry to be good at this. I mean, you know, we weren't the guys that were on Little League, you know, playing Little League baseball, and we weren't necessarily the guys, you know, getting straight A's in school. And so this was the finally, you know, some of us were good at something in our lives, and we desperately chased it. I mean, because we wanted to be good at this. And we really embraced the act of discovery. We each wanted to be first at doing something. And so all of us had our firsts at certain aspects of it.
What was yours?
I was the first guy to sustain going back and forth, hitting coping to coping back and forth, one after the other. Instead of just going up the pool and coming back down and heading into the shallow end, I would hit the left wall and then go to the right wall and literally go back and forth like a pendulum. And if you see skateboarders like Tony Hawk today, that's what they do now. They go back and forth on the ramps, trick to trick. And so I was probably the first guy to be able to do that. And again, we just didn't know if the body could get in these positions and if gravity would allow us to do it.
The first big skateboard competition that the Z-Boys, the Zephyr team, participated in was in 1975. What was your team doing compared to the other skateboarders?
Well, first of all, that was the first contest that initiated the new modern era of modern skateboarding. And it was in Del Mar, California. We came from Los Angeles. We didn't have any idea if actually people skateboarded outside Los Angeles. So it was a bit of a shock when we got there to see 600 other skateboarders from around the nation. And our skateboarding was based on banked walls. It was, riding banked walls and riding swimming pools. And also it was based on the influence of this surfer in Hawaii who at the time was probably one of the best surfers in the world, named Larry Bertelman. And he had a very low approach to surfing and an extraordinarily aggressive approach to surfing.
By low, you mean like crouching?
Yeah, crouching and using his hands, like digging his hands into the wave and pivoting around his hands, like doing what's called a cutback, where his board completely does a 180 on the wave and his board is shooting a gigantic rooster tail. Well, that's the kind of skateboarding that we were doing, which was very low to the ground and screeching all over the place and using our hand as pivot points. Well, when we got to Del Mar, we found that most of the competitors were skateboarding, doing the maneuvers that had been done 10 years prior to that, which were the handstands and the nose wheelies. And it was very much the upright approach to skateboarding. And so we came in there with a different approach. And, you know, people said we looked more like a gang, you know, than a skateboard team, because we were kind of, you know, we had long hair. We were kind of ratty looking. The back pockets on our pants were all torn off because we were always skidding around that. We were getting so low on our skateboards that we were always scraping the back, kind of the left butt of our pants. As well, our tennis shoes were torn up. So I think we kind of had the look, from what I understand, as like, you know, where Endless Summer meets Mean Streets. you know, it was no longer Brian Wilson anymore. This was a different story. And that had to do with where we grew up, because we grew up in such a kind of a multicultural, you know, environment and stuff like that. It wasn't rosy sunsets and clean beaches. This is where, you know, the smog and the soot, you know, landed in the parking lot, and where you rarely ever saw a sunset that wasn't, you know, tainted with a deep band of smog.
You were used to skating in pools and on hilly concrete. When you got to this competition, you had like a flat wooden surface. So what were the things that you couldn't do in this competition, and what did you do instead?
Well, we couldn't do the type of riding that we were used to doing, which was, you know, the tricks that we were doing on banked walls, which were turning up and down, like surfing, in a sense, surfing on banked walls and doing what's called 180 slides and, you know, pivoting around our hands. So what we had to do is we had to apply that to flat ground. And we did the best we could. You know, a lot of the people didn't quite understand what we were doing because they'd never seen that style of skateboarding before, and there was a lot of protest about it. But nonetheless, we did fairly well. You know, Tony Alva and Jay Adams got third and fourth place. Nathan Pratt got first in the slalom. And Peggy Oakey, the only girl on our team, got first place in the women's freestyle. So it was basically a matter of trying to somehow transfer that aggressive low style to just flat ground. And it was skidding around our hands and pumping the board and kind of skidding the wheels out and things like that. It's a little hard to describe, because I've actually never described it before. So I guess it was just a very low approach, an aggressive approach, as opposed to standing up and doing more like gymnastic tricks.
Stacy Peralta directed and co-wrote the documentary Dogtown and Z-Boys. We'll talk more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by National Geographic, featuring travel products including guidebooks, maps, magazines, and trips. Available in stores nationwide or online at nationalgeographic.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, more on Dogtown and Z-Boys with Stacy Peralta. Ken Tucker reviews the new CD by Andrew W.K. And Maureen Corrigan reviews the new memoir by the late literary critic Lorna Sage. What you trying to hand me? This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Stacy Peralta. He directed and co-wrote the documentary Dogtown and Z-Boys about the skateboarding team from Santa Monica and Venice, California, that in the 70s originated the moves that turned skateboarding into a phenomenon, moves that are now considered to be among the origins of extreme sports. Peralta was an original member of the Z-Boys. How did the Z-Boys start becoming well-known outside of the neighborhood?
Well, we were very lucky in the fact that, see, we all congregated at a surfboard shop in Santa Monica called the Jeff Ho Zephyr Surfboard Shop, and they sponsored us, and to get their affiliation was all that any of us ever wanted. And part of the group that worked at this shop, it was Jeff Ho, Skip Engblom, and Craig Stessic were the partners of this group. Well, Craig Stessic was a very unusual character. He was a photojournalist at the time, and he had done quite a few interesting articles for Surfer magazine. And he started doing what is now called the Dogtown articles. He started photographing us and writing stories and chronicling our adventures of sneaking into backyard pools and riding these playgrounds at these schools. And as a result of Craig's articles that appeared in what was then Skateboarder magazine, the Bible of skateboarding in the 70s, we became internationally famous from those articles. And Craig had a very unusual touch because he didn't see skateboarding in a Beach Boys type of way. He saw skateboarding as, as an extension of society, that these kids are looking for something else, that they're not attracted to the team sports, that they're not attracted to the conventional American sports, that they're doing something different. And he was one of the first people to come along and realize that this wasn't just a yo-yo, that this wasn't just another, hula hoop fad, that this was something that needed to be paid attention to. And as a result, he wrote articles that many, many kids around the world could respond to and did respond to.
I should mention that Craig Stessic collaborated with you on the movie Dogtown and Z-Boys, and there's also a book of his photographs.
That's right.
That's called Dogtown, The Legend of the Z-Boys.
Right.
So what was it like when the skateboarders that you teamed up with started becoming well-known?
Well, first of all, none of us ever had a conception that this would ever lead to anything. So when it finally did blow up after the Del Mar contest, we were all being asked to ride for other manufacturers and being offered quite a bit of money. And at the time, I went from making, being like a busboy in a restaurant, making probably $30 a week to making 10 grand a month as a skateboarder. And this was in the 70s. I mean, I was making more money than both my parents were. So it was a shock to me and it was a shock to them because, it just was kind of unheard of. You just don't make money doing something like this. And there was no precedent for this before us. You really couldn't make money in surfing. And I guess only the best skiers in the world could make any sort of money back then. So it just took off like a tidal wave.
So this was what, skateboard manufacturers sponsoring you in competitions?
Yeah, what happened is skateboard manufacturers came up to us and they instantly saw the value of associating with us. And so they decided that the best way to make money in their skateboarding products was to put our names on skateboards. And so each of us went to a different sponsor. I went to a company called Gordon & Smith, which at the time was the number one company in skateboarding. And they put my name on four different skateboard models, very much like, the sporting good companies putting, Mickey Mantle's name on a mitt or Michael Jordan's name on a shoe. It was the same type of thing. It was sponsorship. And so they were selling 100,000 of those boards of mine, a year. As well, I was touring all over the world and introducing the sport to kids all over the world who had never seen modern skateboarding other than through these magazines. So we were going to Australia and France and Germany and England. And these kids were just so hungry for this because it was so different and it was a piece of America that they were finally able to grasp and bring to their country. Because this is a completely American phenomenon. This has no European roots to it, skateboarding,
So you were basically, neighborhood kids who didn't have money skateboarding, and then a bunch of you became pretty wealthy very suddenly. What did that do to your relationships and to the sense that you were a team?
Well, number one, it destroyed the sense of a team because we were no longer a team. We had all left the original Zephyr team and went off on our own to pursue our own careers. And it was an unfortunate thing that that happened, but at the same time, it probably would have been inevitable because there were so many good guys on that team. It's like having the Lakers and the Bulls all in one team. It just isn't going to work. There just is, it's too many mouths to feed. And so at first there was tension because some of us made more money than others. Some of us got more opportunities than others, and it just created unnecessary tension. But in the end, we all became friends again, and we were all, you know, we all became tight. But I mean, I must admit to you, you know, like I said, it was so unusual that this happened, and it happened so fast. I mean, when I was in high school, I was assuming that I was going to be a plumber when I grew up because I figured that would be the only thing I could figure out to do because, you know, there was no future in skateboarding. And so this caught a lot of us off guard. And, of course, it was the 70s, so some of the guys, you know, got a little bit into the rock star thing, and there was drugs involved, and it was very difficult, I think, for some of the guys to handle. They weren't used to making that kind of money, and they weren't used to the fame and attention that came along with it, and it sped up everybody's lives a little too fast at times.
So you were surprised that there was actually money to be made from skateboarding when you gave up skateboarding in around 1980 because of repeated injuries. What other ways of making money from skateboarding did you find?
Well, before the end of my career, I started looking around, and I realized I was very lucky to be doing what I was doing. I was making a lot of money, and I was, quote, famous and doing that whole deal. And I realized that it wasn't going to last forever, and I didn't want to go start selling, you know, auto insurance or something like that I didn't have a feel for. I wanted to start a skateboard company. And so I started talking to different people in the industry over about an eight-month period and finally found a gentleman that I decided to go into business for, a man named George Powell, and we started a company called Powell Peralta, which at that time made skateboards, and we had about three or six employees. And within about 5 years, we had 150 employees, and we were doing close to $30 million a year in skateboarding. It was an interesting adventure and a very worthwhile endeavor that was a lot of fun during the 80s.
In order to make the new movie Dogtown and Z-Boys, your documentary about skateboarding, you had to find the guys who you skated with in the 60s and 70s. You had all dispersed by then. Was it hard to find everybody?
Yeah, there was 12 of us, and it was very difficult to find a handful of these guys. They had simply fallen off the face of the planet and were living so far under the radar, I couldn't find them. And I hadn't seen some of these guys in 20 years. And so I was driving to the production offices one day, and I passed a detective's office. And I thought, that's curious. Passed him a few more times, and finally I thought one day, you know, I want to go in there and see what this guy can do for me. So I gave him a list of the people I was looking for, which one of the guys was Bob Biniak, another guy was Paul Constantino, who were former Z-Boys. And I said, I'm looking for these guys, and I can't find them. Can you help me? And he said, I'll see what I can do. And later that day, he called me and said, I found the guys you want. And he only gave me addresses. He couldn't get their phone numbers. So I wrote letters. I drove to the addresses. I left the letters hoping that, you know, these guys would find them. And a week later, they both called.
That's great. And what were they doing?
They were living just under the radar. I mean, one of them was working in a machine shop. One of them was working as a businessman flying all over the country. But, you know, they just keep themselves unlisted. And they keep a very low profile. So it was tough finding them. But as a result of that, I then used this guy, this detective, to find other people that I was looking for, like people that I knew had footage, whether it be 16 or Super 8, that I had recalled from the time. And so he was very, very helpful.
Do what kind of credit does the detective get in the movie?
He gets
detective
a
work
you.
Or something?
Yeah, I think we. I don't know if we give him a detective work or just a thank you. I'm not really. I don't remember. That's a good point.
My guest, Stacy Peralta, is the director and co-writer of the new skateboarding documentary, Dogtown and Z-Boys. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Stacy Peralta. He's the director of the new documentary Dogtown and Z-Boys about a team of skateboarders in the 70s that he was a part of. Now, you said earlier that you were never interested in team sports. you weren't in the Little League. What didn't you like about football or baseball or other team sports?
I don't like the structure of it. I don't like, well, number one, I detest football, actually, because I don't like sport. I don't like the idea that you're crashing into other human bodies. I don't think there's any finesse in that. There may be finesse as far as being a quarterback, but I just don't think it's a beautiful thing to watch. And I just didn't like the idea of having to get dressed up in a uniform and having to work within a rigid grid. You know, when you stand on the field in baseball, you're working within a grid, and I just didn't like that. And what I liked about skateboarding is that I could do it by myself. I didn't have to rely on a team. If I was good, it was my responsibility. If I was bad, it was my responsibility. And it was all up to me whether I was going to succeed at this or not, and not up to a coach. It was not up to somebody else on the team. And as well, I just feel that there's just more opportunity for self-expression. And I think we were all screaming out to be able to do that, and that's what attracted all of us to it, is that ability to do that and to do it on our own terms.
A lot of people don't like to see skateboarders in their neighborhoods or in their parks. And there have been ways that groups have gone about trying to make sure that these places remain off limits to skateboarders. What are some of the tricks that you've seen people come up with to deter skateboarders, and how well have they worked?
Well, a perfect example of this is in the Embarcadero in San Francisco. It's a huge place in the inner city, and there's a number of cement benches, cement planters that skateboarders like to skateboard on. They've been doing it for about 15 years. Well, the city got tired of them skateboarding, and so what they did is they started developing these little pieces of plastic that they bolt onto the benches and the cement planters that the skateboarders skated on to prevent them from doing their slides and things like that. But what happens is skateboarders are like billy goats. Whenever society puts something in front of them that prevents them from doing it, they'll figure out a way to incorporate that technology into their next thing, into their next technique. And so it's a strange kind of like the lion chasing the gazelle process, where they keep kind of keeping up with each other. So they're very crafty. You know, these are very unusually sharp kids in how they interpret architecture, and they don't see architecture in the way that the original architects designed many of these things to be used for.
I don't know what you'll think about this, but has this ever happened to you? Because I know it's happened to me, that you're walking down the street in kind of a daze, not really thinking of anything in particular, and suddenly, out of the blue, some kid on a skateboard comes by, nearly knocking you down, being totally uncaring that there are actually people walking along the street that the skateboarder is skating down. Does that ever happen to you, and what are your thoughts about that kind of skateboarding?
Well, that was me years ago.
Was it? I figured.
I mean, so I know that. You know, this is the thing you got to understand. These kids don't want to crash into you.
Uh-huh.
And I know it looks aggressive. It sounds aggressive. Most likely the kids look, you know, kind of tattered. But they don't want to run into you. And so our instinct when we see a kid like that is to freeze up and jump. But that's where you're going to get in a crash, where the kids, they see everybody coming, and they're just going to weave in and out of everybody. They're not going to hit anybody as long as people don't jump up and flip out. But I know it's one of those, that's just part of the skateboarding thing, you know. And that's why skateboarding is looked at as being subversive, because it's done anywhere. You know, yes, it's done in skateboard parks where it's made for kids, but it's also done where every kids can do it. And as a result of that, they do it where they're not supposed to, and it ends up upsetting people. And that's why it's kind of got this kind of subversive edge to it, I believe. But believe me, they do not want to crash into you, because they don't want to get hurt either.
Do you skate at all anymore?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm more relaxed on a skateboard than I am walking. And far more relaxed skateboarding than I am sleeping. And I have an 11-year-old boy, and we have a little ramp at the house. And we skateboard together. I certainly don't do it professionally. I mean, Tony Alva still does it professionally, but I don't do it professionally. But it's something I will always do. It's just part of my DNA.
Well, Stacy Peralta, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry. Thank you very much for having me.
Stacy Peralta directed and co-wrote the documentary Dogtown and Z-Boys. It's already opened in many cities and will open in more over the next few weeks. Andrew W.K. is a 23-year-old performer from Michigan. He's a classically trained pianist who prefers to shout out party anthems with single-minded titles like Party Hard and It's Time to Party. Andrew W.K.'s major label debut is called I Get Wet, and rock critic Ken Tucker says there's a subtext to the singer's yelling.
It's time to party! Let's party! Hurry up with yourself and have a crazy party! Hey you, let's party! Have a killer party and party! Don't even try and deny it! Cause we're gonna have a party tonight! And you know we're gonna do it tonight! We're gonna lose it all and we can hold it now! Party! Party! It's gonna be a party tonight! Don't you hear my...
I hated everything about Andrew W.K. until I heard his music. I saw his album cover, in which the greasy-haired young man had intentionally bloodied his face just for the shock value. I'd read that he was an American who'd become a big star in England, where this album was released months ago. I knew that Andrew W.K. gave interviews that sounded like motivational lectures with obscenities thrown in to convey his positive thinking vehemence. But then I heard a cut on a September 11th charity album, a song called I Love New York City, that's also included here, and it's terrific, a literal shout-out to Manhattan, in which the strength of Andrew's vocal cords are a metaphor for the strength of the city after an attack. Now the album I Get Wet has finally been released here, and I love it. This guy is unstoppable. You can listen to an Andrew W.K. song and tick off the influences. The three-chord bluntness of the Ramones, the pounding pop beats of English acts like Gary Glitter, Sweet, and Sham 69, the surly, muscular, inspirational image that the punk poet-ranter Henry Rollins projects. But somehow, as familiar as so many elements of Andrew W.K.'s music are, he's managed to create his own sound. That song is called Don't Stop Living in the Real World, and you can find all sorts of comfort in it, depending on who you are. If you're a concerned parent, you can tap into WK's insistence that you shouldn't use anything to dull your senses to the real world. If you're a kid looking for a way to blow off steam, well, as head-banging music goes, heads don't get banged any harder than this. And if you're someone who's often wanted to get behind loud, hard rock or heavy metal, but just can't stand either the pretensions of the excessive instrumentation or the overwrought lyrics, Andrew W.K. is stripping it all down to its essence. His greatest song so far is Ready to Die, which I know sounds potentially appalling, but listen to it as he talks about cutting without a knife, shooting without a gun, and hear his more complicated than you'd think point. The notion of ready to die as the equivalent of getting ready to live, to really experience the world. story goes that Andrew W.K. did some of his first performances in a Detroit Starbucks, bellowing alone, accompanied only by tracks on a beatbox he carried in with him. How'd you like to hear this guy while sipping your latte? Andrew W.K. is espresso in human form.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Andrew W.K.'s CD, I Get Wet. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews the memoir by the late literary critic Lorna Sage. This is Fresh Air. Bad Blood, a memoir written by the late literary critic Lorna Sage, won Britain's Whitbread Award last year. It's just been published in this country. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says Sage's voice reminds her of Lillian Hellman and M.F.K. Fisher, her illustrious predecessors in the tough dame school of female autobiography. Here's Maureen's review.
It's so commonplace for contemporary autobiographers to confess to some Jerry Springer-sized splotch on the soul that I think it takes more guts now for a writer to own up to the little fragilities that render us human, all too human. In part three of her magnificent memoir, Bad Blood, the late British literary critic Lorna Sage recalls how, as a teenager, she rushed around a windswept English sea resort one afternoon, clinging to her best girlfriend. The two of them emptying coins into every jukebox in town to make sure that Elvis's All Shook Up drowned out the rival sounds of Pat Boone's Love Letters in the Sand. I cringed when I read that passage. In the precise, haunting language that characterizes her book, Sage captures the hysteria of a still virginal but hormonal teenage girl. It's a passing moment of safe sex frenzy that most of us female readers, at least, have also enacted, long before cynicism drew a hip black veil of forgetfulness over the pastel pink embarrassing details. I don't want to give the misimpression that as a memoir, Bad Blood's gimmick is that it memorializes only the mundane. There's plenty of domestic cruelty and eccentricity of character here. The archfiend, the progenitor of the bad blood of Sage's title, is her grandfather, who reigned as the vicar of a tiny Welsh village when she was growing up in the 1940s. Think vicars like the Bronte sisters' gothic loon of a father, rather than those gentle servants of the Lord in Barbara Pym novels. Sage's grandfather carried on brazen assignations in the gorse bushes with the spinsters of the village, while his wife, Sage's grandmother, granted herself a secret divorce and some measure of financial independence by successfully blackmailing her husband with his own sexually explicit diaries. Sage, who spent her early childhood in the vicarage, says what made her grandparents' mutual confidence trick of a hateful marriage more than just a run-of-the-mill case of domestic estrangement was her grandmother's titanic anger. She simply refused for decades to keep up appearances, never cooking, cleaning, attending church, or uttering a good word about men as a species. Like most old devils, however, the vicar boasted some seductive attractions. A book lover, as well as an alcoholic, he taught the 4-year-old Sage to read, primarily to shut up her prattling so that he could drink in peace. The passion for reading he self-servingly imparted to his granddaughter distinguished her in the village school, a medieval institution where the head teacher would walk down a line of children and, ticking off their heads, pronounce which ones were predestined to be muck shovelers. Despite the prevailing village assumption that too much reading was known to send you daft, Sage threw herself into her studies. She also developed early into what a lecherous uncle called the poor man's Brigitte Bardot. And a true good-bad girl, she became pregnant at 16 without realizing she had had sex. Here's how Sage describes the pragmatic unreality of her situation. "My parents' plan was that I should go to a church home for unmarried mothers, where you repented on your knees, scrubbed floors, said prayers, had your baby, which was promptly adopted by proper married people, and returned home humble and hollow-eyed. Everyone would magnanimously pretend that nothing had happened, so long as you never seemed to be having a good time or developing too high an opinion of yourself. From now on, you could count yourself lucky if they let you learn shorthand and typing. Look where so-called cleverness got you." You can tell by her nimble, tragicomic tone that Sage's story isn't going to turn out that way, and indeed it doesn't. There are so many compelling reasons to read Bad Blood, including the brilliance of Sage's literary interpretations, whether she's scrutinizing her grandfather's naughty diaries or the gloom and doom poetry of Thomas Hardy, as well as the vivid and very damp view she offers of post-war rural Britain, where electricity is still a novelty, and the timeless landscape seems to be dotted with people, tramps, village idiots, Polish POWs, just stuck in the mud. The bonus feature of Bad Blood is that it also happens to be a superb memoir of a daughter of the 1950s who got knocked up, but not knocked down.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Bad Blood, a memoir by Lorna Sage.
"Well, bless my soul, what's wrong with me? I'm itching like a man on a fuzzy tree. My friends say I'm acting wild as a bug. I'm in love, I'm all shook up. Ooh, ooh, yeah.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Shura. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Well, please don't ask me what's on my mind. I'm a little mixed up, gonna feel fine when I'm near the girl that I love best. My heart beats so it scares me to death when she touches my hand.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of With These Hands, a collection of stories by Louis L'Amour, author of May There Be a Road. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk to John Burns, a foreign correspondent for the New York Times, about his long-term reporting from Afghanistan. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on the Taliban in 1997. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.